First case on our calendar, 06-1502, State of Ohio versus Clarence Frye Jr. Mr. Doughton.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. I'm David Doughton, counsel for Mr. Frye, along with co-counsel George Tappas. I would request to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, if I could.
Not your time.
Your Honors, this morning, in Mr. Frye's case, it's clear he is the perpetrator of the homicide. That is not at issue. The pervading issue in this case surrounds the first three propositions of law, which I would like to address. That is essentially his waiver of the mitigation hearing, the failure of the court to hold a hearing on replacement of possible replacement of counsel, and also the failure to allow proper allocution. In this case, Mr. Frye apparently was quite upset with the conviction for the A8 spec, which was the killing of the witness. This was a misdemeanor case was pending at the time, and it was the day of the penalty phase where the trial attorneys first brought to the attention of the court that Mr. Frye had instructed them that he didn't want to go forward with mitigation. I didn't see anything or don't note anything on the record prior to the penalty phase, which was held a little bit less than 2 weeks after the verdict came, indicating to the court that there had been a problem. And that morning, the court was first confronted, and frankly, the record does not reflect that under this court's decision under Ashworth, that he knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily dismissed his, or excuse me, waived his mitigation. Ashworth required that the judge, when he learns or he or she learns of that there's a possibility of waiver of mitigation, that they must, the judge must determine through an inquiry whether the defendant is competent, whether the defendant understood or understands his or her trial rights, whether they understand that he has a right to present mitigation and the effect of that. And the judge is required to make findings of fact, backing up that it was a valid waiver of the mitigation. In this case, there was no referral for competency whatsoever. Now, I understand that this court has held that it's not an absolute, that there's no requirement on its face that a competency evaluation be conducted. However, certainly is a factor in this case. At no time did Mr. Frye have a competency evaluation. The judge, in her sentencing opinion, covered that, and here's the problem. The judge indicated that it wasn't necessary to have a competency evaluation because she had observed Mr. Frye during trial, and he had been somewhat disruptive and making eye contact and what she thought had been inappropriate conduct. She also indicated that his lawyers were very experienced trial lawyers, and they had not asked for competency and saw no indication. But here's the problem. The judge nor the trial attorneys are mental health experts. You know, in this case, when there's something waived as important, a competency evaluation should have been ordered. It wasn't, so the record is—
Counsel, what are you proposing would be the trigger? Because you know that it's not a mandatory. So what is the trigger then for the, if the trial court is, or excuse me, the trial counsel is not requesting it, should the judge sua sponte just say?
Yes, in any other case, a judge sua sponte can do that. If the judge in any case, let alone a capital case, believes that from the judge's observation that the defendant is acting inappropriately, the judge has that right to sua sponte order it without counsel. So that's not requested. In this case, there was no inquiry. You know, had the judge perhaps said to the lawyers, this is why a hearing is so important, you know, look, do you guys think he needs a competency hearing? You know, has he had a competency hearing? Is there any history of mental health going on? So there has to be some inquiry put in. Personally, I would like to see it mandatory because waiving, like in this case, waiving your right to the penalty phase is automatic death. And so clearly, you know, when he instructed, it got to the point where the Mr. Frye had told the the lawyers, I don't want you to make any argument. Now he did let him eventually make some statement. But the practical effect of that is under Ohio law, it's automatic death, and automatic death has been upheld in, you know, the United States Supreme Court. So that's the effect of that. So if somebody, by waiving their opportunity to present the reason why death is inappropriate, clearly there should be. But in this case, minimally, there should have been an inquiry into the need for that. And
So, Mr. Doughton, are you saying that any time there is a waiver of mitigation, the issue of mental competence should be raised by the judge?
Well, frankly, yes, but barring that, the next step down is when there's something such as this, where the judge herself observes inappropriate behavior.
But inappropriate behavior in and of itself is not always a sign of mental incompetency.
But I think with what you just said, Your Honor, not always. That's the key. It can be. It may not be.
Isn't that, though, for the trial judge to determine, and don't we defer to the trial judge on factual determinations? Here, we did have a colloquy between the judge and your client before the waiver was actually accepted, did we not?
Yes, we did. But the colloquy in this case was insufficient. And here, to jump to that, it's a good point. It's clear that Mr. Fry was not a volunteer. This is not a person who thought, you know, I want the death penalty in essentially a suicide situation. He wanted to live. He felt he was unjustly convicted. When the judge indicated to Mr. Fry, Mr. Fry indicated his lawyers had been ineffective. He was unhappy with them. When the judge said words to the effect that you're going to waive ineffectiveness if you waive the hearing, Mr. Fry backed off. He said, I can't do that. You know, I can't waive ineffective. That's the issue. Apparently, the lawyer then said, and it's not clear in the record, but the lawyer said something to him indicating that perhaps the trial ineffective wouldn't be waived, because then Mr. Fry did turn around and indicate, okay, then I'll go ahead and waive it. So he had waived, then backed off the waiver, and then waived again on the penalty phase. What was missing in this case was that there was no mention of the A7 specification, or two specifications in this case, and even if the jury would have acquitted Mr. Fry, and there is a sufficiency argument in this case, so there, you know, we do believe there's a problem with that, but even if he was acquitted, he was still death eligible because of the felony murder specification. At no time in the colloquy did the judge indicate to Mr. Fry, you know, if this specification is gone, and if I rule 29 this specification, you're still facing the death penalty. Had your lawyers done everything you wanted to be and you were acquitted of these charges, you're still facing the death penalty. So that if he said, I want to get this right to appeal, Mr. Fry's clear intent was from the record that, you know, look, let's not mess with this sentencing aspect, because if I go to the Court of Appeals and then the Ohio Supreme Court, believing there were two steps, then it's going to be reversed, so the sentencing doesn't matter. That was Mr. Fry's position. At no time was explained to him that, and it could happen here, if this court reversed the A8 specification, he still is death eligible, and because he did not present any mitigation, it's a difficult argument to make on the harmless error aspect, because there was very little mitigation. I know the court has an independent obligation to look at the mitigation available in the case in spite of what Mr. Fry wanted. It's a much more difficult argument to get a reversal on that aspect. That was never explained to Mr. Fry at any point in time.
Counsel, when you say it was never explained to him, you mean it was never explained to him by the court?
There's nothing, yes, that's what I'm saying.
Do we know whether his attorneys explained
the record to him? Is bare on that aspect. I think the inference can be made that if his attorneys did, it didn't sink in, because Mr. Fry's total comments were all directed to the killing of a witness. I mean, his anger was all to the killing of the witness, and there is nothing in the record that even alludes to the fact that there is a second specification which would make Mr. Fry death eligible, regardless of what this court or any other court did with the killing of a witness specification.
Mr. Fry seems like the kind of person who thinks he knew more than his attorneys did. Entirely plausible they did explain it to him, but he brushed it off.
Well, first of all, that's about every client we have. And second of all, it could happen. But again, the court, let me give examples. There, in any case, in a plea case, if a defendant has pled 10 times before, if I appealed a plea case where the judge read half of his Rule 11 rights, the plea wouldn't be acceptable. Even though the record would seem clear that the attorney probably explained it, He has experience. He's gone through plea colloquies before. It still isn't acceptable. The reason is because that defendant is waiving important trial rights, and it can't be done unless the record reflects that he understood what he was doing. In this case, clearly Mr. Frye had not been any death penalty argument. That it is complex. You know, the layers on penalty phase and what happens after the penalty phase, he needs to understand it before he waives that. And I do think that it's important to indicate he wasn't a volunteer. You know, this was a person who thinks, you know, look, they're going to reverse this on the Court of Appeals, and then that way I don't have to worry about the death penalty. That's not the case here.
So, Mr. Doughton, to understand what you're saying, are you saying that the trial judge then, if there is the waiver of mitigation, would have to, on the record, tell the defendant every single thing that an attorney normally would explain about the situation? Is that what you're saying?
That's exactly what I'm saying. If he's waiving the right to present his right to defense, his right to present a defense, his right to present mitigation, his right to live for that matter, absolutely, that he has to understand the consequences of what he's doing. In this case, what should have happened was the judge, well, first of all, I think that there should have been a competency eval because there's no history that anybody had ever looked at him in this way. We just don't know on that matter. Second of all, barring that, he should have been told, Mr. Frye, even if you're right, you can appeal the killing of a witness specification. Even if the Supreme Court agrees with you, do you understand that there is still a remaining capital specification? And based on that specification alone, you are still death eligible. It will do you no good to win that specification. You need to win both specifications in order for you to no longer be death eligible. There was no mention of that anywhere at all. It also, the next step it should be, do you understand that you're, by waiving mitigation, you're in essence waiving almost all penalty phase arguments, penalty phase errors. For instance, if there was a improper jury instruction, yes, it was improper, but the fact that, you know, there was no mitigation available in the record, we can't say that the outcome, the integrity of the outcome is put in doubt based on this error. So that there are major, major considerations that must be done before someone who clearly is not a volunteer waives his right to present evidence.
Mr. Doughton, I'm looking at parts of the transcript where the court said to your client, Mr. Frye, do you understand the effect of failing to present mitigating evidence undoubtedly makes it more likely, or could make it more likely, that the jury will return a verdict of death instead of life imprisonment?
That's
correct.
Which
seems to be an expression by the court of the nature of what you're asking we order be done. And your client's response to the court was, he understood that if I don't put on any evidence in mitigation, these little 12 people here will probably give me the death penalty and send me to death row.
Okay.
Doesn't that suggest that your client understood the consequence of failing to go forward with the mitigation?
That's why it's so important that it be explained. With what was in Mr. Frye's mind from the record is that it's based on this killing of a witness. Mr. Frye also said, these people are going to send me to death row because they found I killed a witness for a misdemeanor. He was dumbfounded by that.
Well, I understand that, but that's really not the issue. What you're asking us to do, I think, is to order that a trial court conduct a hearing. And it seems to me as though the essence of what you want done was done.
No, here's why I disagree with Mr. Frye.
I guess I'm a little confused about it, because if a trial judge tells the defendant, you know, you can't just waive this because it has grave consequences and you could face the death penalty, and the defendant says, yeah, I know, that's what's going to happen.
Because Mr. Frye believed that was based on the A8 specification. In his mind, he said—
How do you know that he knew that it was based on that specification?
Because that was the only—
That's not in the transcript.
The only specification, the only aspect of any specification addressed was that aspect.
Well, we can't get into what might have been in his mind, but we can get into what the court told him and what his response was to the court, which seems to fulfill all of the requests that you're having us order.
Well, why I would disagree with that position is the fact that when you're waiving mitigation, he, in all of the conversation, was about the killing of a witness. There was no mention whatsoever by anybody of the A7. Mr. Fry's position was, if I go to the Court of Appeals and it's reversed because I think this evidence is sufficient, I have nothing to worry about. I mean, and so his position is, why are we bothering with this sentencing when this aspect's going to be reversed by the Court of Appeals anyway? And so this is a waste of time because, you know, get me an appellate lawyer, get me to the Court of Appeals. And that's why it's so important that he understood that there were two specifications. That's why it's so important that when you're waiving, it may be the most important right that a defendant ever waives. And when you're waiving mitigation, you have to ensure you know all aspects. Another example, Judge, might be the Ohio law doesn't allow you to plead guilty to the death penalty. If you plead guilty to the death penalty, 11C3 requires the court to have a full evidentiary hearing on the specification or the specifications. A three-judge panel must have the prosecutor put on testimony that is subject to cross-examination in order for the judge to even accept a plea to understand that there's independent of the defendant's wishes, that the court in this state of Ohio, all of us, that the integrity of the system is in place because we don't want somebody to get the death penalty where it's not appropriate. So it's correct. Required. So if it's required even on a plea to have a full evidentiary hearing subject cross-examination, if you're waiving your right to present mitigation, it would seem clear that every specification be addressed and every aspect of the waiver be addressed, which wasn't done in this case.
Well, the court asked his counsel, Mr. O'Brien, whether or not he felt that the, Mr. Fry understood the consequences of failing to introduce mitigation, and you feel the decision was knowingly, intelligently, and informed. And the counsel responded, it was an informed decision, Your Honor. What should the court rely on? He's talked directly to the defendant, and he's also addressed counsel.
That's why for this, the court... The
responses are consistent from the trial court standpoint.
Because it's not known what did the lawyer inform the client. What did the lawyer tell the client?
Well, that may be an ineffective assistance claim, but it's surely information coming to the court firsthand from a defendant and then from counsel who has informed him.
On a plea, Your Honor, if I stand up at a plea and I tell you, which I've done with you many times, and said, Judge, my
and client, done well, Mr. Dowd.
Yeah, I can handle that part of it. If I end up and say, my client understands his rights, you still independently have to, I know Mr. Doughton has spoken to you about your rights, but I'm required to go over them in detail in spite of what he says, and that's what's missing here. Right. And the other problem is, and again, Mr. Fry, I understand, brought most of this on himself, and I'm not saying otherwise, but that's why I'm arguing that the court, that the state of Ohio, we all have an independent interest in making sure that this is done properly. What also came out in the backdrop, kind of segueing into the assistance of counsel, is a large part of him not wanting to put on mitigation was based upon his not getting along with counsel. That he was angry, he wasn't talking to them, which put somewhat, when his lawyer said he understands everything, we have this disconnect of Mr. Fry being angry with his counsel entirely. It started at the beginning of trial. There were motions early on. During the trial, there didn't seem too much. But again, there was the judge, and he asked for new counsel or wasn't going to cooperate with those counsel. There was no hearing put into that either. Which brings us up, and I have a few more minutes, into the allocution issue. In this case, the trial judge, as in Donna Roberts' case, filed her opinion, her required opinion, before the hearing ever took place. And there was, obviously, this court has over and over again held the right of allocution is very important. Ohio gives a defendant a opportunity in elocution to present mitigating evidence. You know, the court must consider what he says in that. The judge, I am sure, filed the motion prior to the hearing, assuming that because Mr. Frye had waived his mitigation and had waived his unsworn hearing and had asked originally that the lawyers say nothing, although he relented and allowed them to say something, that he would waive elocution too. That never happened. There was no inquiry into the waiver of elocution whatsoever. And the problem with that is, when he asked Mr. Frye if he has something to say, Mr. Frye already is aware he's been sentenced to death. So we have this situation where the judge unilaterally took away his right to elocution. And regardless of what he had done in regard—
Well, counsel, are you stating or speculating that his elocution would have been different had that judgment of the court not been known at that point?
Clearly it would have been different. Now, how much—
I mean, my understanding is he put forth justification for killing the victim here because she robbed him, took his property, and then he went through the reason why he thought that that was egregious behavior, and based on how he was brought up, this was, you had to deal with it.
He had made that statement to police detectives, that's correct.
But didn't he say that in at court as well?
That was his position throughout, that's correct. But again—
But that's not, you wouldn't consider that mitigating, would you?
No, absolutely not. Okay. But again, we're put in a position where we're saying because he had waived mitigation and had not allowed attorneys to present anything at mitigation, that he was going to maintain that same position. Maybe he would have, but maybe he would not have. And the point is that there was no waiver. There's no request of waiver. It was just unilaterally taken away from him, which, again, this court has deemed on many occasions the right to elocution is very important and can't be taken away unilaterally by the judge. I don't know what he would have said at that time. We can all speculate, but that's the point. It's just speculation. And for this reason, Your Honor, and there's also angry antipathy between the client and the judge, understandably why the judge was upset him, but she also had indicated to him at the hearing that she wanted to put a sock in his mouth, you know, which, of course, would only antagonize the situation further, because when a judge gets to the point, and it's human, I understand, that she has to tell these things to the client, the proper thing to do would have frankly taken a time out, you know, taken some time, had a hearing because of the consequences were so grave. Not only to Mr. Frye, but for all of us. If somebody's going to waive and go into what would become automatic death, it's incumbent on all of us to make sure the procedure is done correctly, regardless of
is it shown in the record that Mr. Frye knew of the filing of the judge's order? I didn't get that impression.
On the direct appeal, no. On the direct appeal, the record was filed ahead of time when she asked him, or when she comes out to ask him if she had something to say, which she did do. He threw up his hand and what's the use? And I think the inference is very fair to be made that his attorneys had that, because she mentions in the record, she said, I filed my report. I mean, she says at the hearing, I filed my opinion earlier today. But does the record absolutely say that I'm not going to say anything because I know you've already said? No, it doesn't say that.
But counsel, the judge actually filed the sentencing opinion.
Correct.
Before the sentencing hearing occurred.
That's correct.
And the sentencing hearing did, apart from the statement made by your client, were there victim impact statements or were there statements by the prosecutor made at that hearing?
Yes. Yes. In the opening statement, the prosecutor did allude to, you know, many victim impact.
It's rather unusual, though, for a sentencing entry to be filed before the hearing on sentencing occurs.
It's unusual because it's improper. It's very unusual, and that's, I mean, you didn't hear either side for that matter. But in a death penalty case, you know, the victim impact obviously didn't affect her at that stage because she'd already put in, but ordinarily there would be objections to the victim impact had she not already have filed her sentencing.
And there was no objections voiced at the
allocution.
Turned out to be the allocution based on the fact that earlier that day, there was the sentencing order filed.
That's correct.
Well, didn't it get filed at 1:06 and the hearing was at 1:16?
Correct.
Were counsel aware that the judge had already made the determination?
That issue is addressed more fully on post-conviction, but the record here is silent to that. I can tell you it was in the post-conviction, but that's not the on the record here. The record is silent to that aspect, which again is why there should be a hearing. I see that my time is up, so that we would ask that you remand it for a new sentencing hearing. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Doughton. Ms. DiMartino.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Heaven DiMartino. I'm here on behalf of the state of Ohio, the appellee. We are asking that this court affirm the conviction of sentence of Clarence Fry. We would submit that the trial court did not commit error in not replacing either of Mr. Fry's attorneys prior to mitigation. The trial court complied with this court's standard in State v. Ashworth when it accepted Clarence Fry's waiver to present mitigating evidence. And the trial court did not commit prejudicial error in filing the sentencing order on July 11th.
Why isn't that a problem? Why isn't it a problem to have the judge sentencing somebody in writing, filing that sentence, and then saying, now we'll have the sentencing hearing?
The record in this case shows that on numerous occasions, the court inquired of Mr. Fry through his counsels and directly of Mr. Fry with regard to whether he was going to give a statement at mitigation, with regard to whether he wanted to give an unsworn statement to the jury at mitigation. He had indicated he was consistent throughout. His attorneys indicated that in the record. He never intended on testifying. It was clear from the record he had no faith in the jury, the particular jury that heard his case, or the jury system. It was obvious that he was not going to give make a statement at allocution.
Well, but the mitigation and allocution are two different things.
Mm-hmm. But it
and
is
under the subsection F of the statute, it tells the trial judge that the sentencing hearing occurs before the opinion is actually filed.
That is correct. But I'm just offering as an indication of what the record shows, that it was clear throughout that Mr. Fry was not going to give a statement. The court's entry was filed at 1:07. The hearing was scheduled at 1:15. There's nothing in the record to show what time the sentencing hearing actually took place. There's nothing in the record to show that the sentencing entry was actually filed before the hearing. And there's certainly
no. Do you dispute that?
The record is silent. I don't know whether it was filed before the hearing
started.
We'll
have to go on the record that says that the hearing was at 1:15. There's nothing to dispute that, and we'll have to go with the time-stamped copy that the sentencing order was filed before the judge had the sentencing hearing.
Right. We'll have to assume that the entry was filed 8 minutes before the hearing started. There is no evidence in the record that Clarence Fry knew that the sentence was filed. There's no evidence in the record that the prosecutors knew that the sentencing entry was filed. Certainly, there is nothing in the record after Clarence Fry speaks at the sentencing hearing that would cause the court to change the sentencing entry. The court certainly could have put out another sentencing entry if at allocution Clarence Fry had made a statement that would have changed the court's mind as to whether or not the death penalty was appropriate in this case. In fact, during sentencing, Clarence Fry was being disrespectful to the court, had to be removed into another room. And when he did make a statement, his statements were, you can do whatever you want to do if you all want to put a needle in my arm and poison me because I killed that thieving whore. Do what you have got to do, but I hope she burn in hell. So his statement indicates that he didn't know that he already got the death sentence, and his statement certainly indicates that even if she had given him the opportunity to allocute before that sentencing entry was filed, he was not going to say anything that was going to change the court's mind. His opinion all along was that Tamela deserved to die because she, quote unquote, stole his stuff. He never indicated at any point that he had any remorse or that he had any, respect for her life. His statements were consistent throughout the trial and throughout allocution. So if there was error in filing that statement prior to going into the hearing, It was not. It was harmless error, and the court certainly could have issued another sentencing order. With regard to...
Yes, counsel, what fault do you find with Mr. Doughton's, maybe you've already answered it, but with Mr. Doughton's suggestion that particularly where there's a breakdown or at least a lot of tension between the defendant and his counsel, what fault do you find with his suggestion that the requirement should be that the trial judge fully advise the defendant of the consequences of his or her waiving the mitigation?
I think that in this case, the trial court judge went above and beyond any inquiry that she was required to make. I think that if we're going to require a trial court to assume that there's a breakdown in communication just because an attorney and the client don't seem to get along, that's going to put an undue burden on the court. There's no evidence that there was a breakdown in communication between...
Undue burden on the court to advise the counsel of the consequences of waiving mitigation?
The court, I don't know how many minutes,
3 or 4 minutes, maybe 5 minutes?
Well, to determine whether or not there was a breakdown and then to say, well, I feel that there's a breakdown in communication, so now I'm going to go back through the consequences of mitigating. Is that what you're asking? Or just to, in every case,
well,
advise?
Well, I think Mr. Dowden's suggestion is in every case, but in this case, we have this at least tension between the, it's obvious the defendant didn't trust his counsel, didn't follow his advice and so forth. And it seems to me there might be a higher burden on the trial judge than to be certain that, particularly in a death case, that the defendant understands what he's giving up when he says, I want to waive, I don't want any mitigation, I don't want to talk.
Well, the court did inquire first with regard to whether there was a breakdown. There is no evidence that there was a breakdown in communication between the attorneys. Even when Clarence Fry moved to waive the mitigation hearing, to waive presenting evidence at mitigation, he inquired of his attorneys on page 1915 of the transcript again as to whether or not he should do that. And then when the court advised Mr. Fry that he could give an unsworn statement to the jury, he asked, can I confer with these guys again on page, I believe it was 1920. So on two different occasions, he again conferred with his counsel. So he did not have a breakdown with them. He obviously was dissatisfied with the fact that he was convicted. He certainly had issue with, in his opinion, he didn't think he should get the death penalty.
Just so we know, your word is breakdown, mine is tension.
Right. I think there's tension any time you would have a capital case, and I believe that in...
This much?
The record in this case looks like Mr. Fry and his attorneys, I don't think that there was any excessive amount of tension. I think that Clarence Fry had exhibited difficult behaviors throughout the trial, but I don't think that those were tantamount to necessarily tension between his attorneys. I think that Mr. Fry was just... you know, difficult to deal with, and he was disrespectful to everybody, including the court.
Ms. Martino, what about that improper behavior or difficult behavior? Did it rise to the level of needing to question his competence?
In this case, the court did accept into evidence. Mr. Fry did allow some mitigating evidence, which was Dr. Sadal's report, which showed that he had a high IQ and no mental illness. The court did observe the behavior throughout the trial. He was able to assist his attorneys, did have two attorneys who are well-respected, have handled a number of death penalty cases, who felt that he was competent. So it does not appear from the record that his behavior rose to the level of being unable to appreciate the nature and proceedings and or to assist his counsel. In fact, when the court inquired of him, do you understand what it means to give up mitigating evidence, he understood what it was. He said, if I was going to give mitigating evidence, that would mean I would present all things that would show that I was a good guy, and that would help the jury say, this guy doesn't deserve to die. So he clearly understood the proceedings. He understood what would happen if he gave mitigating evidence. He understood what could happen if he didn't.
Wasn't his concern basically not so much with his attorneys, but he considered that the 12 jurors were too, quote, dumb to understand what they were doing? And it would be fruitless to give them more information to work with because they just were too dumb. What do you call them, the dumb dozen or something?
The dummy
like that?
12. He called them consistently. He had no faith in the jury system. He could not fathom that 12 persons could find that he deserved the death penalty for what he considered to be a misdemeanor. And his issue was with the jury. It was not with his attorneys. He at one point said, if I was paying them, I wouldn't pay them. You know what I'm saying? But that was just his dissatisfaction with the fact that he was convicted. He never asked for another attorney. The only instance in the record where he discussed the right to counsel or new counsel was at arraignment when he asked for an African-American attorney, and at that point, he only had one of his attorneys appointed. It was never raised again, so that was not an issue here. He certainly had tension, and it was certainly a difficult proceeding based on Mr. Fry's behaviors in the court. He was, you know, it's all in the record that he was disrespectful to the jury, to the court, to the victim's family, but he was not incompetent. He certainly understood what he was doing, what he was saying, and showed absolutely no remorse to the end. The jail calls demonstrate his opinion of the victim, and his statements to the court indicate his complete dissatisfaction with the jury system. It was never an issue with his attorneys.
Counsel, why did Clarence Fry go to the Knox residence on the 31st of July?
The state's theory was that he went to the residence to convince Tamala to drop the charges. The jail calls after he was arrested for the incident on July 18th indicate that he knew he was on probation. He knew that conviction for the assault, as it was indicted at the time, could result in him having his probation revoked and him going to prison. He did not want his probation officer to find out about his arrest. He wanted Tamala to drop those charges. The record indicates that Tamala was afraid when he got out on the signature bond and that she intended to proceed with those charges. So the fact that they were a misdemeanor would have had little effect on the ultimate consequence would have been that he could have gone to prison. So he went to that house to intimidate or threaten her. And perhaps it would appear that his plan was if she did not acquiesce and she did not drop those charges, that he would kill her. And there is sufficient.
So what was presented to the jury? What did he go there to talk about the clothing that he thought she had sold?
It was presented.
Did he go there to kill her?
The evidence was presented.
The prosecutor had to argue something in opening and closing.
The prosecutor argued that he went to the house with the knife concealed in a bowl with the intention of intimidating her so that she would drop those charges and, if necessary, to kill her so she did not proceed.
Did he force his way into the...
The evidence was that he did not force his way in, that he went to the 6-year-old grandchild who was there and witnessed the murder, and the 6-year-old said, "You may not go in." He went in anyway, and there was a discussion. The 6-year-old testified that he asked, that Mr. Fry asked Tamala, "Where are my clothes?" That Tamala said they were not here. The 6-year-old indicated that Clarence Fry stabbed his grandmother. The grandmother asked him to call 911.
What I'm trying to ask you then is, what criminal offense did he go there to commit?
The prosecutor would argue that he went, the case at trial argued that he went over there with the intention to intimidate the crime witness, the victim, so that she would not press those charges and to commit a felonious assault with the knife. And that his prior calculation and design was that if she did not acquiesce and did not cooperate, that he would kill her so that she would not testify. And there is sufficient evidence in the record that that's what he did, that he went over with a knife and committed those two.
Well, where I'm going with this is Ohio's death penalty statute was knocked down 2 or 3 times by the U.S. Supreme Court because mm-hmm. it was not narrowly tailored.
Mm-hmm.
When it was reenacted, some of the key witnesses argued that felony murder, in some circumstances, if applied incorrectly, could result in a bootstrapping, mm-hmm. that is, counting the same thing twice. And as I look at this, even though it's not raised as a prop, I don't think, in this, I have some difficulty seeing that the burglary here, as to how you get a burglary, is he went there either with a deadly weapon, or he went there to kill her, and that's counting it twice, the same thing, to get to the death spec.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you clearly have it seems to me, on the killing to either prevent her from testifying in the future or retribution. Certainly, he said enough that the jury could be convinced that he killed her as punishment for what she had already done. So paragraph 8 spec seems to be clear, but the burglary spec strikes me that you're using the same thing twice. And that would not be narrowly tailored. In other words, if the same act that gets you death is the act that gets you the burglary, that seems to me to be inappropriate. And I don't think we've seen that in any case that I can recall, where you're double counting the same offense.
Right, and the state would argue that we're not double counting the same offense. He could have committed the burglary without killing her. He could have gone in there to just scare her, to just intimidate her, to just...
Well, didn't you have a spec of he went there with prior calculation and design?
With prior calculation and design, correct.
So how does he go there with prior calculation and design to kill her, and at the same time, then you dial it back when you get to, this is how we have burglary, is we have some offense of intimidation. If he just went there to intimidate her, then he didn't go there with prior calculation and design to kill her.
Could have gone there with the intention to scare her, which is what he indicates on the jail calls, and when that didn't work, he brought a knife that was sufficient with, you know, just, it looks like, 4 stab wounds and a few incisions to cause her death. So his prior calculation and design could have been, I'm going to go into that house, I'm going to enter without permission, I'm going to scare Tamala, and if she doesn't acquiesce, then I'm going to kill her. And those are 2 separate things. And it just so happens that, you know, the person that he went in to kill that day was the victim of the crime, of another crime, and that's why the other charge is there. But certainly he could have gone there with the intention to scare her. He indicates that over and over on the jail calls, that he's going to go over there, he's going to scare her, she's going to drop these charges. He tries to threaten her.
Well, if he went there just to scare her, then it would seem that his claim, gee, I got mad, I had this knife here to cut noodles, which seems far-fetched. But I got mad when she whacked me with the ashtray, and in a fit of rage, I stabbed her to death. Now, that's not prior calculation and design. So it seems to me you're trying to have it both ways. That's a problem I have from time to time with what prosecutors do in these death cases. It's to be narrowly tailored. You have it on the one. And by the end of the trial, now you've got these issues of whether or not the jury was told that these are merged. You wouldn't have that problem if you didn't
right.
Try to reach too far.
Well, in hindsight, it's always 20/20. You don't know.
Well, I guess what I continue to press for is a little more foresight when you start these things out.
And this case did, you know, develop as the case proceeded. I believe that those two death specifications, the A7 and the A8, are not duplicative, and this court certainly will make an independent review as to whether or not the death penalty was appropriate and whether the court double counted A7 and A8, but I don't believe that the court did. I believe that the record shows that he went to that house clearly to intimidate and to scare her, and that the other part of his plan was that if that did not work, that he would kill her so that she did not speak. And his statements on the jail calls to Tamala as well as to his mother support that. You know, the threats he made to her, the suggestions that he has 2 toe tags from killing other people, the fact that, you know, he tells her, you don't know me. Him and his mom talk about tricking Tamala to drop the charges. He clearly knew that her testimony, that her pursuing the assault conviction could land him in prison because he was on probation. He went there to scare her. When that didn't work, he finished what he went there to do.
Part of your theory is he thought this all through. He had plan A, plan B. I have some difficulty figuring out how clearly one of a high level of intelligence is thinking is, gee, I'm going to try and intimidate her out of pursuing this, but if she won't, I'll kill her. Now, that really doesn't advance his cause of freedom very much, does it?
I'm sorry?
He doesn't want to go to jail for beating her up.
He doesn't want to go
So his alternative plan is, I'll kill her.
And then argue it was self-defense because she allegedly hit him with an ashtray, which is the story that he has stuck with all along, which is completely not supported by the record and far-fetched to the point that he tells the police that when he left, he was still carrying his bowl of noodles, and lo and behold, what's in the bowl? The ashtray. I mean, he stuck with that story and argued self-defense.
Yeah,
he stuck with it on the jail calls from West Virginia.
It really seems to me he went there to kill her, period. He's carrying a butcher knife on the way in. He's talking about having a knife to cut noodles, which is far-fetched. Seems that like that's really your case. He went there to kill her, and he did.
He also, there are some indications in the record that he thought, you know, Tamala was the best thing that happened, and she was keeping him, you know, more on the right path than he had been. Maybe he thought he was going to convince her otherwise. Maybe he didn't want a third toe tag. Maybe he thought he got away with two murders, and he didn't think he could get away with the third. We'll never know. What we do know is that, you know, right to the end, he continued to disrespect her. You know, he called her a thieving whore, hope she burned in hell. He killed her in front of her two grandchildren. They found her, you know, deceased with her two-year-old cuddled up on her.
Well, but yeah, that, I mean, that's tragic, that's a tearjerker, but that's not an element of whether or not you get death.
It does go to show that he could have gone in there with who knows what intentions of scaring her or murdering her, and his backup plan was, things don't go right, I'll have to kill her. You know, it could be because the grandchildren were there, he decided to go ahead and murder her. We'll never know. All we know is what's in the record and his, you know, complete and utter lack of remorse and respect for the court and the judicial system. If there are no other questions, I'd rest on the brief.
Thank you, Ms. DiMartino. Mr. Doughton, you save 5 minutes of your time.
Mr. Doughton, I have one point of clarification.
Sure.
The prosecution has indicated that your client not only wanted to waive mitigation, but he made statements that would lead the court to believe he was not going to give a statement in allocution. Do you agree with that?
Well, to a certain extent, yes. I mean, I understand the logical inference of if he's waived everything else, it's logical that he's going to waive the next step, too. The problem is that we can't allow that. We have to ensure that each independent right is protected and ensure that
And the reality is, once she had the hearing, he did make a statement, although I wouldn't say it was a statement that particularly helped him.
I understand.
It doesn't have much remorse in it, but he did make a statement in allocution after the fact, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Mr. Doughton, would you go so far as to say that some stages are not waivable? I mean, I'm trying to understand what rule you're looking at in terms of the mitigation, because if we were to say that there will never be a waiver of mitigation, that's another way to ensure that a defendant has everything before the jury that needs to be before the jury.
I don't think I could go that far. Even with the right to counsel or any right, I think a defendant always has a right to waive. I would go so far as to say that if you're going to waive your right to live, in essence, that there should be a very stringent standard to ensure that the defendant in that case understands all the consequences to what he's waiving. I don't think it would pass muster because the individual does retain those rights, and I don't think we could go that far. But I do think we can ask for a much stronger record to ensure that Mr. Fry understood exactly what he was waiving. I would like to point, Justice Pfeiffer, the bootstrapping argument was raised in Proposition 10 in this issue,
yeah.
And there was merger was in 15, so those were addressed. Also, as far as the when the opinion was filed on transcript page 2029, the judge flat out says the court has issued an opinion. I mean, she says on the bench at that time, I'd already issued an opinion, so I don't
think... Why could the court not have modified that based on the allocution of
the defendant at
the hearing?
I think the court might have been able to do that. If the court said, you know, I made a mistake, I should have heard what you have. It's my error. I am going to strike my prior sentencing. I'm going to listen to what anything you have to say, and I will file a second opinion. I think that probably would have been proper, but that's not what happened in this case. But I think, theoretically, could that happen? Yes. I mean, courts do that. Courts make errors in sentencing entries and correct them. I wouldn't think that
would
have been.
But if there was no reason to correct it other than the timing, in other words, the court, after hearing the statements made by Mr. Fry, was probably more thoroughly convinced at that point that the order that had been filed was the correct order, that there was no doubt. Maybe that reinforced it. So why would the judge vacate that only to refile it?
Because the judge will have, in essence, waived his allocution. I mean, if any sentence entry filed before they've heard it, any sentence entry, and again, in this case,
The judge doesn't waive the allocution. What happens, or I guess the consequence I see, is it could be argued that had there been something proffered by Mr. Fry that should have been taken into consideration and on an independent review would indicate that it should have impacted the sentencing order, I think we'd be in a different position. But your client...
But we're speculating. I mean, that's the problem. The missing link is, again, on direct appeal, I'm stuck with that record, I understand. We don't know if he knew of that opinion, if his lawyers had that opinion, if the issuance of that opinion affected what he said. We don't know that from the record. If the record was very clear as to that, perhaps, Your Honor, that could happen, although my position would be no, in any such right, it has to be individually, each right, one step at a time, you have to go over and make sure he understands waiving allocution or giving up allocution, what effect that would have. That discussion was never had, as far as, you know.
He didn't waive it, though.
Pardon?
He did not waive it.
But it was inconsequential. We don't know if what he said was affected by the judge having made her decision before they even walked into the court.
Well, you're speculating. Let's just presume that since there's no evidence to the contrary, he was allocuting in front of the judge. What he said would not have given the judge any reason to modify the sentencing order that had been filed 7-8 minutes before. So what is the reason that you're, I mean, I can't see, I'm troubled by what the judge did, absolutely.
I understand.
But I'm trying to understand whether or not that's has an impact here.
Well, I guess has an impact here is pure speculation. I would concede that in certain situations, it may not have an impact. I guess what it comes down to is whether that right of allocution is going to be enforced to the point where judges have to be instructed that you can't file a sentencing opinion. This has happened multiple times.
Well, it's 292903F says that the court shall file the sentencing entry within 15 days after the court imposes sentence, and the hearing is to occur before sentence is imposed.
Clearly.
So, I mean, there's a violation of the statute in the very least.
And I took, absolutely, and I took Justice O'Connor's statement as, can we find harmless error on a violation of the statute? Mm-hmm. This court, and I guess Carol Dean Plus is a classic example, shall mean shall. Shall mean shall. And if we're going to start cutting hairs, that's a slippery path.
You've used your time, Mr. Dowd.
Okay, thank you very much, sir.
Thank you. Case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.